So I'm Rick Hansen, and it's April 29th, 2015. Very good. And this is an interesting one for me, in that I was trying to come up with a talk, with the usual fireworks, the 17-point plan. And the truth is, for whatever reasons, I think at the tail end of one of those colds sweeping along. And so I think I've lost IQ points, I'm sure, just hopefully temporarily. And the interesting thing is, so I'm going to kind of use this as a way into something, which is that I found that when I sat down here, of the two, if you will, Buddha characters here, I did what I sometimes do, which is to swap out the more masculine character and bring forward the more feminine, Tara, the embodiment of compassion, if you will. And it was very interesting. I had a very strong feeling for doing that. And I think the reason I did that was that I didn't feel that well. And I'm okay. I really am okay. It's a passing thing. And it's the point of my teaching tonight, which is what I'll call last resort and first resort. And I'm struck by the Buddha's comment about his own dharma as good for people who are at the beginning, good for people who are intermediate, and good for people who are advanced in their practice. Good in the beginning, good in the middle, and good in the end. What is that teaching? Which is good in the beginning, good in the middle, and good in the end. Continuity of value. And I noticed that in terms of when we don't feel particularly good, or something has happened. You know, maybe we've lost a beloved pet, or our children have moved out and we're sad about that, or we hoped for something good with someone we met online and was dating and it just didn't turn out, or, you know, something has happened. And what do we do? What's that last resort, right? When all else fails. And what strikes me about it is that we tend to drop down into the whole, out of the parts. And this is, I think, one of the deep teachings that's really useful in the beginning, the middle, and the end. It's this process of disengaging from parts, opening into the whole. And so when I see the more feminine form of the Buddha there, it reminds me of a kind of, whether it's feminine or masculine, a kind of nurturance that opens us down into our whole experience. Sometimes we can't make it better. We can't solve the problem. We can't bring back the lost person. We can't unbreak the vase. We're sick. Something's happened. Whatever it is, what do? There's this last resort where we just kind of go down into the totality of the way it is, including especially in our own experience. What's it like in the body? The totality of the body. What's the whole of our emotion? What's the whole of our desire, including our frustrated longings, our wishes to have things be different or have something go better, have a business that we've started actually succeed and doesn't look like it will, perhaps, you know, but we can't. And if you think about it structurally, almost all suffering, I would argue probably all suffering I can think of, has to do with a part struggling with a part. Whether it's a part of this body struggling with the part that's that body or that situation, or more commonly, a part of the mind struggling with another part of the mind. Kind of a silly but common example is you see the cookie, and that's in your mind, the perception of the cookie. I think the cookie's also out there, but as far as we're concerned in the virtual reality of our experience, it's in the mind, okay? So cookie. Second part is I want the cookie. So there's an I who wants the cookie, or desire arises for the cookie, right? And then on the heels of that comes this other part that's critical that says, you can't get into your genes any longer. What are you doing eating the cookie? Right? And then there's another part that says, screw you, asshole. You sound just like my stepmother. And on we go. Right? Right? And the chorus goes on and on. Then another part says, whoa, Tara Brach would never be like that. And that's another part. Right? That's the nature of so much of suffering. It's parts tussling with parts. And you can kind of watch it on a really, you know, slow motion time scale, big aggregated parts struggling with other big parts, or little micro parts, micro processes, but it's parts struggling with parts. And on the other hand, sometimes when we just give up. We can't do it, you know, it isn't working. We feel the way we feel, the event is the event. You know, there's a natural process maybe, something has happened. And we just go, buh, right? And what's the last resort? We just drop into the hole. I think of times when I've been really sick, or maybe you know as well, or times when you've been really injured and your body's really whacked hard. You can't make plans, you can't fight anything. All you can do is just surrender to being all of it. But when you surrender into being all of it, oh my goodness, what a peace that's found there. You know, and there's a kind of peace, a happiness even. Certainly it just feels like a peace in being the whole. I think that's our last resort often. And it also strikes me that sense of being the whole is really deep in our nature. It's kind of like our home base, actually. It's kind of the foundation. For example, when we first wake up, right, the first 5 seconds, 5 minutes, coming into wakefulness, especially in the beginning, it really feels like various circuits are starting to come online. You know, the sense of I, the plan, what am I going to do today, right? Maybe I'll get a cookie today, whatever that is, you know what I mean? Or, oh dear, I've got that stupid meeting. And, you know, but before all those various things, all those circuits kind of warm up, there's this initial basic sense of whole, right? Just body whole, alive. There's this here. It's really simple. It's very elemental. Verbal processes are not yet happening. There's just consciousness here, you know, here. And, you know, in the architecture of the nervous system and back in evolution, that primal sense of just being body hearing, here hyphen ing, being body here ing as process, is, I suspect, present in very simple animals above the level of zombies. Maybe tiny little worms or zombies, but at the point that animals started having experiences, I think, you know, lizards have experiences. I think crabs have experiences. You know, I don't know about, I think fruit flies are having experiences. In any case, deep down in us, really central, even when people are dementing. You know, I was with a man who was dementing somewhat last week, and you could tell that there was a sense of whole, even as the parts start breaking up or breaking down. The whole persists. It's kind of our last resort. But I also want to talk about it as our first resort in a couple kinds of ways. One is, I was thinking about interpersonal issues, right? There you are in a tussle with some person. You know, I'm thinking about raising teenagers in my own case for the moment. Or I'm thinking about people in relationships where there's something that's not going well. And right there, there's such a strong tendency, isn't there, to, you know, go into parts, like my view about you, right? And this very intensified sort of sense of you or the company or that part which is a class of people, men, women, transgenders, beyond language, whatever. You know, we put them in boxes, right? Different boxes, and then suddenly it's a part. That whole box, that set is a part, right? And yet, so often, that's where trouble really is rooted. That as soon as we go into that kind of dualistic, separated, me versus you, us versus them, you know, part versus part, or part trying to get something from part, then we're in a problem place. Whereas if we go more into a sense of what's the whole, you know, like in family systems work, in psychology, what's the whole system? In physical health, what's the whole body as a system doing that's systemically leading to this illness condition in just one part of the body, in just one organ or system, for example, or in a family, or in a relationship, or in a work company, or a neighborhood? What's the whole? I had a tussle of sorts with a neighbor about a fence, and the facts on the ground were that we made some, because you share fences, so we agreed to split the cost. And the facts on the ground were that the fence ended up costing about $3,000 more than the contractor, the builder, anticipated and told us. I kept the other person informed, but the bottom line is my neighbor said, nah, I'm not going to cover my half, my $1,500 of that extra $3,000. Just ain't going to do it. Don't want to. Really? Yeah, just don't want to do it. And well, neighbor issues can become quite nasty and prolonged, especially if they don't move away, you know, if they move away. So we call psychology a geographical, you know, they're kind of gone. There you are, you're sort of stuck with them, right? So I weighed my options. Mostly I internally went grumble, grumble, da-da. And I noticed that for a while in there, you know, I would just like hold that grudge. I'd see the guy, because he was mostly the source of it. And it just didn't like that. And I started reflecting recently about how that dispute between us, in a sense, and that I ate the cost, I ate it, or my family did, as part of a much larger whole, in which I happen to know the kind of business he's in wasn't going that well. You know, I happen to know, I could hear the family yelling at the young adult kids there, you know, the teenagers, some pretty intense stuff going on. I knew there was a larger whole there. I knew there was a larger whole too. You know, there is kind of like levels of thoroughness, you know, like, you know, cutting corners, thorough, conscientious, numbingly thorough, neurotic, insanely thorough. I was probably somewhere with him, you know, I was kind of distracted, a lot was going on. The builder himself was sort of flaky and chaotic, and a lot of stuff was going on there. Some of his people were, you know, sort of clearly hungover just about all the time they were working on our fences. Amazingly, the fence is vertical. It wasn't, it could have been like that. Anyway, so a lot of stuff's going on, and so in my own way of being with it, I wasn't numbingly, insanely, oppressively, neurotically thorough. I was merely thorough, but that wasn't good enough, really, in that situation. Usually it is, it wasn't. Point is, a lot was involved with it. When I go out to the sense of the whole about the situation, I still had to eat $1,500. It wasn't mine to eat. Okay, that's what the Buddha called the first art of life. Unavoidable, inescapable, inevitable pain or difficulty. But then I realized that if I open more into a sense of the whole about this situation, all the parts of it, the complexities and whatnot, the bigger picture, you know, then I'm not throwing second darts at either myself or his family. You know, I'm not grumbling about his dogs, you know, giving them the stink eye. You dog. You know, like, all these stupid second darts, right? They're hurting me, not him. So you see the idea? Opening into the whole. And you can think about other situations. Doesn't mean denying the impact. You know, I started with the kindness to oneself, the generosity to oneself we would extend to others, you know, standing up for our own rights. But at least reducing the collateral damage of all those other second darts. Right? You can kind of feel it. You just think about it. What's the larger perspective? The bird's eye view, how are we in this department or this family or this couple or this nation or this human species, world, whatever. How are we parts of a larger whole? And how does disengaging from parts and disidentifying from parts and opening into a larger whole, how is that a first resort, not just a last resort as well? And then I think about our experience, you know, and that's one thing we often do in practice, and you may recall my instructions or suggestions tonight, the meditation, especially at 7 o'clock, where I talked about, you know, what it's like to just kind of sit, opening into a sense of the whole body, rather than attention being localized in one part or dancing from part to part, be the whole body, and then opening further out into the whole of experience, you know, witnessed by a kind of witnesser, a witnessing, and then opening out further into the whole of mind, which includes awareness and the witnessing process, subjectivity, sometimes called ipseity, this innate element to our experience. So what's that like? And when we do that, it's really interesting. You just start getting really peaceful and really happy when you open into the whole of mind. And even if in that whole of mind is physical pain or emotional pain, somehow you're opening into a peaceful spaciousness in which that part that's painful or disturbed is occurring. So really, and I think some of what we do when we meditate is to train in that capacity. So it becomes more and more accessible to us. It becomes something more rapidly we can resort to. And it starts kind of infusing how we are in general. Right? Clear? Sir? Okay, get that idea. And it's right there in front of us. At any moment, if you look at your experience, there's all of experience. Whoops. All of experience, or more broadly, all of phenomenology, all of consciousness, including awareness, in this sense of a witnessing process. But the witnessing process, if we just take it as a part, subject, object, then we have parts again. But if we take the witnessing process as just involved with or an aspect of the whole of mind, that's a deep practice, I think, which then takes us into ultimate matters around this business of parts and wholes. And I want to just repeat the point about teaching that is useful for beginners, for intermediates, for advanced, wherever, to whatever extent those words mean anything, useful in the beginning, the middle, and the end, the same teaching, useful at different places along the way. And so this teaching I'm about to get into, I think of is both advanced in some sense. It's really, it's about the ultimate. And it's also really useful right where we start. So, quoting two people. The first is Kalu Rinpoche. Kalu Rinpoche, no longer alive, Tibetan teacher. And you can see a picture of him in this quotation at the Gratitude Hut at Spirit Rock Meditation Center, if you care to do that. It's a beautiful picture, a beautiful quotation. This is a very close paraphrase. He basically says, here's the quote. He says, you live in illusion and do not see the way it actually is. Seeing the way it actually is, you know that you are nothing. Knowing that you are nothing, you are everything. That is all. Are you kidding me? Wait. Yeah. But that's right there, you know. Living in illusion, you know. When you see what's really true, you see that you are nothing, which I think means, you know, in this Tibetan teaching, you recognize that everything is empty of absolute self-nature. There are no somethings. Everything is just a very transient patterning of everything in that way of looking at it, which was implicit in the early teachings of the Buddha, and the Mahayana, especially in Tibet, really brought this out. Okay? So I think that's part of it. But in the recognition of not being a something, in other words, being nothing, in other words, not being a part, that has any absolute self-arising, self-existence, takes you out into everything. You know, right? This particular wave in the middle of the Pacific, it's all high and mighty and fancy. Look at my seaweed, bro. You know, is actually kind of nothing. But recognizing that it's nothing, suddenly, you're the whole ocean, everything. Okay? Pretty far out, huh? And then, there's another quote from a very different tradition. What's interesting is how great sages and saints often, they say remarkably similar things from utterly different places. You know, two fingers pointing at the same moon. And this is from Nisargadatta Maharaj, a really interesting, ordinary man. If you don't know much about his story, it's quite remarkable. He had a tiny little shop. He sold cigarettes. Chain smoked his life, ultimately died of lung cancer, and had some profound awakenings and became quite a teacher. And some of his writings are just remarkable. And so Nisargadatta Maharaj, and he says, "Wisdom tells me I am nothing. Love tells me I'm everything. And between these two banks, the river of my life flows." What? Yeah. There you go. Good in the beginning, good in the middle, good in the end. Last resort, first resort. Disengaging from parts, opening into wholes. That is all. Comments, feelings, thoughts, inquiries?
The example you brought up about the neighbor, I think we can all relate to that.
The letter?
Oh, the example about the neighbor, I think we all can relate to having an experience like that. But I don't completely understand the connection. I mean, how you, you know, because you're still there, the neighbor's still there. And how did you manage to get yourself out of that agitated state of mind by looking at the larger picture, or I didn't quite understand.
Oh, yeah, exactly. When I started thinking about the larger picture, I could have made that connection more explicit, so thank you. With my neighbor, it's really funny. I think it's like stimulus response. When we're glued to the stimulus, their term in psychology is stimulus bound, then we get really upset, right? And it's as if they've infected our mind. Right? We're then they're like they've invaded. Right? Whereas when we see the whole, we disengage from the parts. That alone makes us feel better. It's like putting a shock absorber in. Like I could replay, trust me, and did, that little righteous gleam in his eye where he got one over on me. And I think part of it was class, too, you know, like the difference between what I do for a living, what he does for a living. And I could just watch that. I got one on you, buddy. Right? I could get really into that face. And when I think about it, you know, I'm going to be pretty darn upset. Second dart, second dart, second dart. I'm like glued to the dartboard. You know, except I'm the dude who's firing the darts. Bing, bing, bing. Oh, that hurts. That hurts. Quit doing it. I'm doing it, you know. So that's a lot of it. And I think there are other reasons kind of neurologically, whereas popping open to the big picture can really help us feel better. Now, it's really important to not do a spiritual bypass, to use this kind of global stuff as a way to avoid feeling the feelings, going down into the belly, really feeling what it's like. But that's those feelings, if we really open into them, it's like an opening into the whole of our experiencing. It also is important to not use these methods with other people if they'd be annoying. You know, you notice what it's like when you're really mad about someone who wronged you and some well-meaning or not always well-meaning other person says, see the, you know, you got to see the big picture. Yeah, like the big picture you, you know, right? So I think we have to be thoughtful about that. I'm not saying anything about that. But I am just inviting you into your own experience. What's it like, you know, like when you're really just tired or sick or nailed or even just waking up, what's that feel like to go into the hole? Is that helpful? And, you know, and in a sense, the last resort and the first resort. On the other hand, when you hear a quotation like that from Nisargadatta, you know, nothing, everything, between those two banks, the river of my life flows. That takes us also into something quite profound. Great.
So to bring it to an event that happened here in this group earlier, as people know, oftentimes the rooms next door and across the way are being used for other groups, and sometimes in the transition there's a lot of noise outside. And tonight, when there were people talking out there as we were beginning our sit, I went out and I gently and respectfully, you know, just pointed out what was going on here and if they might be able to take the conversation outside. I had to go a second time because the conversation didn't end. And a lot of stuff came up around, hey, this is our space, your time's up, you know, over with, this kind of stuff. And the second time, they were very accommodating. You know, we'll go outside. And but one of the gentlemen who was out there said, you know, we're talking about a student who recently died here at the university. Mm-hmm. And it just reminded me about, well, what you're talking about. Yeah. At one level, it's only sound.
Yeah.
On another level, there are different parts of this whole that are producing that sound that are obviously more than just entitled to making some noise, sharing. And it just reminded me about the importance of sharing the space.
Yeah.
And being mindful that we're part of something much bigger than what just goes on here in this room.
Yeah, thank you very much for saying that. Yeah. And, you know, there's something too, if I could say it, that speaking of, you know, good in the beginning, good in the middle, good in the end. For me, one of the most fundamental teachings early on was I was a college student. It was in the early days of the human potential movement, and I started reading Carl Rogers and reading things about sensory awareness. And for me, it was a radical idea, the idea of coming down into the whole of my experience. Because it seemed to me that intelligence, as I understood it from reading hard science fiction, was about being kind of like a disembodied computer, numb from the neck down, right? And, you know, you had feelings, but it was really not, it was about distancing from them. And I just want to, again, underscore that as a fundamental building block, certainly of practice. The Buddha super emphasized self-awareness, you know, including owning. So you might think of so much of neurosis or issues, you know, as even Freud pointed out, in terms of the return of the repressed, that when we shove stuff away, when we push that part away, you know, that sensation in the body, that anger, that shame, that memory, that sadness, when we push it away, then we suffer. Right? A part of us is pushing another part of away. Whereas on the other hand, if we really open to our feelings, you know, and resource ourselves enough to really feel the feelings, to really open fully into the body, to really feel all of it. A student here committed suicide yesterday.
Aww.
That's what they're talking about. And jumped off the Richmond Bridge. Yeah. And to feel it. To feel all of it, you know, including the gladness that, you know, oneself did not jump off that bridge, you know, even at some time in your life, maybe you thought about it. I just want to remind you about the importance of that and the way that that's a path, you know, opening into the whole of experience. It's a beautiful path, and it's available to us all the time. Do you have any questions about how? to open down into the whole? Mm-hmm. Like what concretely, please?
I do have a concrete question. Yeah. I'm just going to use myself as an example. Yeah. It's kind of personal, but I don't really care. I tend to wake up in the morning feeling very distraught.
Yeah.
And I've done everything with it and about it. And as of recently, I've just been going like, okay, here it is again. Just take me. Whatever it takes this morning. And so I'm experimenting. It's a new approach. But I would love to have your comments on that.
Well, thank you for saying that. And I'm sorry that's happened. And it's weirdly common for many people to have that morning kind of anxiety, distraught, depressed mood sometimes. Then it kind of gets better as the day proceeds. A practical suggestion has to do with my hunch that part of the reason for it is that at that point, we're often at our metabolically lowest ebb. So if you find yourself waking up at, 3-4 in the morning or a little before you actually, and then you go back to sleep, maybe get up to use the bathroom or something, one thought is to eat a little at that time, like half a banana, something kind of wholesome, has carbohydrates. It'll help you go back to sleep, and it might kind of even that out a little bit. So and that's one thing. The other is to just recognize that maybe the experience is, in a sense, kind of impersonal. It doesn't mean anything. It's unpleasant. It's a first start for sure, not minimizing what it is at all. But it's kind of like that's what the body goes to when the physiology really slumps and the alarm signals start going off or the internal defenses really drop and other stuff starts coming forward. And so sometimes just getting up, moving, speeding up, getting the metabolic rate up can help it clear. You're not suppressing it, you're changing the causes of it. So those are just kind of thoughts in passing, okay? To the larger point, I don't have this exact thing. I've been in situations where I woke up and I was fine until I realized where I was and then the dread kicked in, the worry kicked in. Like I've been there, right? And what I'm suggesting is that there's this natural process that something happens, okay, and we're caught by a part of the mind, whether it's distraught or irritation and people talking outside maybe or some goal we have, we're caught by it. But fairly quickly, with practice, and especially with repetition, it becomes more and more of a habit, we can open into a sense of being the whole mind having this part of an experience. So distraught, let's say, or irritation, or drivenness, or physical pain, whatever, it's an experience inside a larger whole, kind of a larger matrix. And it's been my experience very much, and it makes sense to me, that when we go into the whole, things really change. The part may still be distraught, irritated, driven, in pain, but at the whole, we're kind of at peace. We're free. So that would be maybe, and I honestly would be quite, I'll be here in 2 weeks. I'll be here in 2 weeks. I'd be very interested in your experiment. And you can use this with anything that's upsetting. And I think there's a natural trajectory. In the beginning, we're caught by the part. Okay. Don't make yourself wrong for being caught by the part, because then that's another part criticizing you for being caught by the part, right? But as soon as you can, explore what is it like to recognize that this part, is nothing. It's not a something. It's empty of absolute self-existence. It's just a part of a whole. It's like a local ripple through a vast tapestry of threads, a network of causes. See what that's, check it out. Yeah. Good, this is really good. How to do this concretely. Yeah, what else?
So you're thinking about the whole meaning, putting attention on all the causes, or is there...
Yeah, thank you for clarifying that. I mean it in two ways. You're helping me clarify it. One way is, and I find it's helpful, to see how whatever's happening, like maybe I'm irritated about my neighbor in the fence, or I wake up and I'm not saying this is true about you, it's true about many people. I'm just prone to depression, and it's at its worst first thing in the morning. Okay, whatever that is. So one way to be with it, this is more, is to recognize kind of all the parts, what's causing it, right? You start realizing, oh, there's biology, there's my personal history, there's my parents, there's the phase of the moon. I would not be here were it not for World War I. I would not be standing here. Maybe somebody else would, but I wouldn't. Because my parents met, my dad from North Dakota, a cowboy on a ranch, my mom, the daughter of a nightclub hostess, basically, meeting in the Army in 1945, the end of World War II, which had its roots in World War I and so forth. I would not be here today. So you start, when you do that, what's really interesting is you start kind of having compassion, you start seeing the bigger picture, you start lining up. So that's useful to do. But what I'm focusing on here is something that's really very immediate and not that intellectual, it's not that conceptual. It's just to be the whole of your mind now. Like be hearing, tasting, seeing, touching, tasting, smelling, and thinking, emoting, remembering. You know, if you just, it's not mystical, it's not magical, it's right under our nose. There's just the mind process occurring, including its aspects of awareness and a kind of subjectivity, a witnessing, that the whole package. And what's powerful is to go into the whole package. And I think a lot of deep practices are really about that. And there's some ways into it, including follow the sensations of breathing in a large part of the body, like the torso, and then go into the whole body. And you start getting a sense of just being the whole. Fairly often, especially in the beginning, you kind of snap out of it and you start thinking about it. So a part of you is reifying a part of it, you know, turning it into a concept. All right, so then you're in parts world, right? But then you go all parts world again, just sitting, being, all, right? And that's what I'm talking about. And then it becomes, to finish up here, because I will finish up, it really does become like your resort. And I actually like that because it's the ultimate resort. Real, it's like Disneyland. It's better than Disneyland. You're in this place that's peaceful, it's whole, it's ongoing, it's all right. And you feel like you're the whole thing anyway. And you extend, you start feeling like you're the whole of reality, you know, the natural world, not in any kind of grandiose sense or, you know, but just gets lighter and lighter. So to conclude, Kala Rinpoche and Nisargadatta Maharaj, you know, you live in illusion. You don't see the way it really is. When you see the way it really is, you see that you are nothing. Knowing, you know that you are nothing. Being nothing, you are everything. That is all. And then, of course, Nisargadatta, you know, wisdom tells me I'm nothing. Love tells me I'm everything. Between these two banks, the river of my life flows. So, let's sit with this for a minute. Thank you very much. Take care.
Thank you.